Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is Henrik Palmgren. The website is redeyes.tv. And of course, as always, it's a pleasure to have you with us. So thank you for tuning in. Well, today we're going to address Brexit. Finally, well overdue. It's I have to admit, I'm late to this party. This is late in the game. We should have covered this in much more detail weeks ago. Anyhow, the vote is upcoming now Thursday, the 23rd. And I have with me today three of the primary figures behind MajorityRights.com. I think the website has been online for 12 years now. Our three guests is GW, Kumiko, and Daniel. Thank you so much to all of you for joining us today. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks very much, Henry. Good to be here.
Hi, Henry.
Thanks.
Excellent. Hey. And so I wanted to ask you guys, I think GW might want to dodge this one, but can you guys just say a few words about yourself, you know, before we get started into the main topic? Kumiko, can you tell us just briefly about yourself?
Well, I should let Daniel go first.
Really? Okay, I'll go first then. My name is Daniel Sienkiewicz. I'm an expat from America. I was born and grew up in the greater New York area, New Jersey specifically, in a very diverse situation. Many blacks in my town and the adjacent town, and Jewish people and other minorities. I was always bothered by anti-racism and liberalism, but was rather alone in that concern and in groping for ways to deal with it. And there was a buildup. There was this buildup for a time through the 70s and 80s where there was a narrative, but not really the dam of political correctness hadn't exactly burst. Then by the late 80s and early 90s, it did. And I tried to, I took the position that I might go back to university and try to advocate white men, actually, in the way that that minorities were being advocated. And I made my way somewhat through graduate school, but found it wasn't going to happen. And eventually, I to save my sanity and myself, I bailed out and moved to Europe, and have been grappling with different ways to try to advocate white people ever since, until I arrived at the positions that I'm at now.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Kumiko.
Okay. Well, I've lived most of my life in the third world. I only came to the UK in 2006. I work in the defense and security sector, and my whole position on what's going on presently, I believe that basically in order for Europe to control its own destiny as a continent and for it to be a good trade and global development partner for Asian countries, there has to be a real conversation about Europe's historical role in the world and the justification of that role, as well as how European states can resolve the crisis of legitimacy that their governments are presently facing. I'm sure we all know what that crisis is. We're in it right now. I think the Europeans should stop indulging in this mawkish sentimentality and guilt narratives, and they need to instead accept responsibility for their security, no longer clinging to vague and incoherent ideas of human rights and tolerance. The watchword should really be the situation dictates the response. And so that brings me almost inexorably toward ethno-nationalism for Europeans, because the nation state is the strongest repository of political experience, and it's from there that you'll find the best way to deal with the crisis that they're presently facing.
All right, very good. And by the way, GW, let me ask you, just if we have any potential newcomers with us, what should they know about majority rights and some of the things they can find on the website?
Well, it's been around a while, so there's quite a lot on the website. MR was set up originally to try to resolve a problem, really, in my own mind about how to bring together people to a generally nationalist state of mind. I wasn't a nationalist in any ideological way. I came out of conservatism, but my instincts were always very nationalist in kind, and I wanted to try to understand in my own mind why it was that people like me, who seem to have the political practice I had, which is a conservative political practice, still could not assemble a sort of response that had a ethnocentric basis. So this was a question that I felt I could answer basically by bringing in all kinds of people from the general right of the political spectrum, and to just let them loose and let the thing roll, but to have in there a very strong nationalist strand, a really core of it all, and to see how that was received and how it influenced others. And it did produce some amazing results, but it also produced a lot of very destructive results. And there was much more heat than light, and I learned less from it, really, than I wanted to. And I made a change in 2008, and the blog became more interested, really, in trying to resolve the same question, but from an intellectual perspective. And that's where we stand today.
All right. Thank you so much. Now, obviously, I'm really interested in hearing more here where you guys stand in terms of the upcoming vote here. And it's on Friday, June 24th, by the way. But maybe you can kind of initiate this a bit for us here, GW, because you wrote a good piece on this on the website, both about the politics and, of course, the meta politics of the upcoming vote. Give us some background to where you stand on this and what it is that is at stake when it comes to the choice to leave or not for Britain.
Well, politically, of course, it's not a great deal for nationalists. If you look at the tenor of the people involved, they're all very pro-immigration. They don't have any sentiment that you would regard as being ethnocentric. That's completely verboten and removed from all discussion. And so you would say, well, all of these people are civicists or culturalists or multiculturalists. They are going to argue this out in a way that completely excludes the imperatives that we sense. Just take a quick sip. The underlying politics, however, or if you like, the intrinsic politics, the metapolitics, are important for nationalists, because this is part of what Marine Le Pen called the struggle between globalism and nationalism, or globalism and the people, the elites and the people. And as such, there are dynamics in which this thing is taking place, and in which the general possibility to have political outcomes and the conversation about political outcomes can be moved gradually but surely and finally towards us, because once it's moved our way, it's never going to go back the other way. So there's quite a lot at stake about this. Every little inch that the underlying politics in the event can be pulled towards us is an encouraging and permanent advance. And that's the take I have on it. So as a nationalist, what's important for me isn't really the kinds of things that they're talking about, you know, the economics and, you know, arguing about whether we have an Australian point style system and all of that thing. I'm not really that interested in that, but in the way that this thing is developed towards our quite distinct and different worldview, towards our imperatives and our interests, towards the life of our people. That's the thing that interests me in all of this. And I do see this whole event as being historically important in that sense. I can see that over a period of time, we've tried through political means, nationalists have tried through political means to influence the thing and to try to find votes at the ballot box and so on and so forth. And that's not produced the change we want. But just by accident, this has come up. And it is a very important opportunity in what you might call the war of discourse, which we're trying to fight. Mm. So there you go.
Very good, very good. Now, let me just kind of go around the table here, I guess, Kumiko. Yeah, please jump in.
Yes, I'd like to jump in there, not to contradict anything that GW has said, but to perhaps add a slightly different perspective. When Marine Le Pen says it's a conflict between nationalism and internationalism, I'm not so sure that she's actually correct about this. And the reason for this is because I'm looking at this from the perspective of remembering the United States exists. And so I'm sure that many of you, being older than me, remember the end of Bretton Woods, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the American dollar still remained preeminent as a reserve currency, vehicle currency of the global financial system after this time. And so, rather than actually losing any policy autonomy, the US essentially gained autonomy from doing so. U.S. banks could accumulate liabilities in their own currency, augment their competitive advantage thereby, and then they made Wall Street become the epicenter of global finance. This, of course, in turn, then consolidated U.S.'s ability to shape the preferences of borrowers and lenders worldwide. And so I would say that what happened here was not necessarily globalization, but actually the rise of what I would call the dollar Wall Street regime. The EU placing shackles on itself through the EU institutions and the way that the European Central Bank operates was almost like the shackles that allowed it to be in a situation where the United States was the one who was exclusively able to engage in expansionary demand-side economics whenever they wanted to. And so they can defend their exorbitant privilege, and no one else can do anything about it. And so I don't think that we've actually had globalization. What we've had is national activism by the United States and international passivity by everyone else. Exiting the European Union or doing anything that actually undermines the ability of the US to use the US dollar as exorbitant privilege actually results in greater internationalism occurring. But this internationalism occurring is actually kind of like the flourishing of other nations that are not the United States. And so paradoxically, it is almost as though actually doing internationalism the way that it is described would result in something which is quite different from what they're presently calling globalization, if I could put scare quotes around that. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I see what you mean. It's an interesting point. It's of course it takes it into a different realm. Whether you know the internationalism that they say would, you know, how that would affect Britain and other European countries differently. But let me just ask you guys where you just, let's begin this simply, where you guys stand on it. Should Britain leave? Daniel, let's take you first.
Okay, sure. Well, I absolutely favor Brexit because for a couple reasons. It fits with my the ideology of my advocacy. That is to say, I advocate the genus of European peoples, but also the species of European peoples and preserving their distinct kinds. So, and I believe that nationalism is the most solid way to do that. I of course favor the native nationalism of the British, but it's also important because it stands to break up the European Union, which I think is, as it is, a pernicious institution, which is a structure that's become a means of internationalism, of neoliberalism, and YKW prerogatives. So, but with a Brexit and a breakup of a hopeful breakup of the European Union that might follow, perhaps that would cause the Eastern European countries to have to develop this intermarium between the countries Poland, Hungary, Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine, Latvia and Estonia, Slovakia and Czech, maybe a few others. And that is very important, as I see it, as a bulwark against the neoliberalism and the propositionalism that's coming out of some of the Western European countries, notably Merkel's Germany, and also as a bulwark against the similar kinds of problems in the power structure of the Russian Federation, as much as they might be mixed up with Jewish interests and objectivist neoliberal interests as well. So this can possibly be the beginnings of a bulwark of nationalism, that is the intermarium of Eastern Europe in cooperation with Britain, and then establishing a cooperative network along the Silk Road with China and Japan, hopefully. And then any other reasonable ethno-state that wants to cooperate, that's wonderful. It's not about antagonizing other European peoples or other peoples anywhere. It's about defending ourselves against their imperialism and their neoliberal in positions.
We're talking about an internationalism which is international.
Right.
It's not a system which requires the sort of Judaic homogenization of everything.
Quite the opposite.
That's why
I want to cooperate with China and Japan, because I feel that they are strong enough to help us overcome Israel, Jewish interests, and Islam, and perhaps the biopower of Africa can be a threat as well. So I think that they're strong. They're a worthy potential partner.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about that. I mean, you have to.
You're not worried about it. Jewish interests.
We're Europeans. You know, we have a history of doing the most immensely interesting and adventurous and courageous things. And I don't see that there's a problem in terms of biology. You know, I don't think we've changed.
I don't think culturally,
I don't think it's had that effect of changing us out of that.
We could use allies, though, is all I'm
saying. We do need allies, of course. But what we really need, more than anything else in the world, is freedom from the structures which are currently dominating us. And,
That's why I believe that
the EU is one of them.
But that's why I believe that we can't singly depend on standard political structures. That we've got to begin to coordinate on the basis of our genetics, curating our genetics and coordinating in his defense. It's an extrapolation of the nation is your skin concept, and I extend that to invitation to anybody with Europeans.
This is where you end up, isn't it, when you have a situation where one is confronted.
There's almost no choice. I mean, really, it's just ridiculous. I mean, we got to save ourselves.
Well, if you look at how badly the European Union has treated the so-called PIIGS.
Yeah.
You can really see it. This structure does not work. What happens is that Germany essentially sits at the center of it. I know it sounds really cliche because, you know, there are so many people who are pointing toward Germany on this, but it's actually true that Germany sits at the center of this. And in its attempt to maintain itself as the sort of, you know, industrial powerhouse hegemon, it sits at the center and influences the ECB to adopt economic policies which allow Germany to maintain itself as the industrial center of Europe. Everything else is sacrificed to that end.
Yep.
Whole economy is destroyed. 50% unemployment rates among youth in what was it? Was it Spain that was experiencing
Spain,
this?
Yes, 45%. I think I heard.
45%. I mean that is one of the highest in the world. I mean the only thing I've ever seen that matched that was like the unemployment level in Libya just before it imploded.
Wow. Yep. Some people, you know, I've had this idea that, you know, the European Union as an entity is reminiscent of something of a European empire or something like that. And some people actually argued that it can be salvaged in some way or changed, that
it can
be reformed, right? What do you guys think about that?
I used to believe this. This is where my position comes from, because I was extremely, extremely pro-European Union up until only just recently. And the reason for this is because if you look at the history of how the European Union was created, everything that happened after the Marshall Offensive from 1947 onwards was essentially about laying down the foundations so that you could actually create a situation where you'd have European working class limiting itself to only economic demands but not nationalistic ones, so you could have a sort of integration of the continent. This allowed them to have a confrontation with the Soviet Union that was coherent, because by having a continental-wide system of production, you could then coherently draw a line and have this European area that was being created that would later take on the coal and steel pact, which would then develop into the European Union. All of this was supposed to be a partner, the economic partner, for what NATO was doing in the military sphere.
Mm. Right.
And so all of this made complete sense. And securing Southeastern Europe from Russia was, of course, the reason for why, you know, Yugoslavia had to be dissolved and broken down into its component parts, and then it too integrated into the European Union. All of this made logical sense if you look at it through the prism of preventing Russia, or the Soviet Union obviously initially, but after the collapse of the Soviet Union, preventing Russia from being able to assert itself in those post-Soviet spaces. All of that made complete sense. However, the European elites have completely ruined all of this now, because everything that was sacrificed and everything that was done to build this area has been sacrificed because they decided that they were going to invite a lot of people into the European Union from North Africa and the Middle East, who they were simultaneously at war against after September 11th, 2001. And this is supposed to somehow make some kind of policy sense. The whole thing is going to implode if they continue going on this way. And in fact, when they talk about how, you know, one of the systemic risks to the European Union is Brexit, they need to go back a little bit further and realize that no one would even be talking about Brexit if they hadn't done the things which led people to be pushed toward Brexit in the first place. If they had behaved like responsible stewards of the continent, you would never have had a Brexit. People would have actually been satisfied and content to continue along the path that had been chosen. The only reason we're now at Brexit is because they essentially ruined it. And so I was pushed into Brexit despite having been very pro-European. Pro-EU. Pro-European and pro-EU are two entirely different things, of course. But, I mean, pro-EU in terms of what its original mission was. I was very in favor of the EU until it became apparent that actually it cannot be saved. It is unreformable because every single time there has tried to be a reform, people have maneuvered in every way possible to shut down these reforms. There's a resistance that comes structurally from inside of it that you can't seem to reform it. I think this is the fourth time that people have tried to reform it now, and it has still not worked.
Kimiko is making a point about the invitation extended by the European elites to North Africans and latterly Middle Easterners, Arabs and what have you. But I mean, this goes back a lot further than September the 11th and has in its arising some mysteries which we as nationalists would like to have answers to and don't, which is, you know, how did it come about? How did it come about that our political class, not only in one country, but all across the West, decided that this was the way to the future? When did they decide this was to be the case? I believe that a decision was taken in Finland, for instance, and probably in Sweden, purely on sort of adventurous liberal political grounds that, you know, we must have diversity, when there was absolutely no cultural or historical foundation for such a decision. So you have to say, well, okay, why did people think like that? How did this come about? Because understanding that has got to be an important component in understanding why, after 2001, say, or 2002, 2003, when the war was being fought in Afghanistan and Iraq, why these further invitations were extended, and why so many of these people are being asked in now with the situation in Syria. This is a open question without the earlier answers. And I've seen some pretty good history done. I mean, we have some pretty good history done on MR's website by a blogger who's no longer with us, but did some good work. But he didn't get to the very core of it. And there's been some other work I've seen elsewhere, just on the British situation, which was very interesting. But there does need to be, at some point, a serious scholarly investigation from a pan-Western or pan-European standpoint as to why this event, this multiracialization, ever took place, who for, who took the decisions, how was resistance, for instance, Enoch Powell, sidelined, how did the political class in every country become so singular in its attitude towards this? How did this massive, really massive and impressive lockstep, uniform way of viewing this subject amongst the liberal elites and a huge sector of the Western politically aware come about? How did this damn well happen? We have to have the answer to that, I think. And as far as I'm aware, there's only, from our side anyway, a great deal of supposition, mostly based around power of jury, and criticism of liberalism and neoliberalism. But I don't feel that that's enough, and we really need the history.
I've got a suggestion that might cover part of it, because the things that you have mentioned, liberalism and obviously, you know, certain organized minority groups who feel that they need to have as much diversity as possible so as to make themselves most comfortable. We've heard these theories before. But another one I'd like to add is I think that with regards to the European Union, or I should say the European Economic Area in general, I think there's an element of protectionism which is going on. Perhaps that elites in these particular countries, particularly industrial elites, were faced with the hard choice after 1973 of basically either they were going to outsource, you know, the base of their power into the periphery. And by periphery, in this case, I mean, you know, Southeast Asia, Latin America, and China, literally. Yep. Or they were going to maintain the industrial base inside of Europe incomplete as much as they possibly could, and bring workers in from all of these diverse locations in order to try to make themselves profitable in this way rather than mechanizing. And so this is the impression I get when I read much of what the economists are saying, that, you know, in order to keep European Union working, you have to bring in all of these workers and so on. And anytime someone says to them, well, no, instead of bringing in workers, why don't you just outsource things to them instead? That way they'd stay in their locations and do the work there. They don't want to hear this for some reason. So I think
But they've done both, haven't they? I mean, there's a chap who's been putting, well, I think it might be a woman, actually, who's been putting on some of the newspaper threads I've read, different newspaper threads, a long and very concerning list of British companies which have, for one reason or another, decided to relocate or have been smashed apart by this process. And it is an enormous list. And you look at this and you start going down and you think, well, Christ almighty, you know, what on earth is left?
Yes, in Britain's case, I think Britain differs from what's happening presently on the continent only in timescale and how they reacted. Because initially, Britain was trying to keep everything inside of the UK. For instance, the textile industry in the UK went out, I think it was before I was born, though. So it must have been like 1960s, 1970s, right? When the textile industries collapsed in the UK?
The big influx collapsed probably in the late 60s. The big influx was from 1954 onwards of Asian workers.
And so I think what they were trying to do at that point was they were trying to keep the industry inside of the UK by inviting people to come and staff it. However, it was doomed to collapse because technological innovation elsewhere always defeats throwing warm bodies at the situation. And so it was doomed to collapse anyway, which resulted in obviously higher levels of unemployment because those things were still outcompeted by the Asian counterparts.
Didn't you say that Merkel was shown that...
I'm about to get to that, yes. And so the UK took a different path because the UK seems to have, I guess, quote, learned the lesson earlier, even though it took on many, many migrants. And so that's why you're seeing a lesser amount of migration coming into the UK now than is coming into, say, Germany, for example, because Germany never actually learned the lesson in any context at all. So now that Merkel has been shown that you can have mechanization, you can just have everything running by itself, she has to ignore this because the cheaper way to do it is just to bring in more workers rather than to actually innovate.
Well, that's so costing more money, though, at the end of it.
Exactly. Ultimately, it fails because for the same reason that it failed in the 1960s when Britain tried to bring everything from Asia into the United Kingdom. Predictably, it was going to fail. And you're thinking, hold on, and you're thinking, how can they be continuing to do this if they know it's going to fail? It's because many of the persons who are involved in financing all of this are doing so on the basis that even if it fails, you still owe them money afterwards. So, for example, this is why George Soros says that there should be something called surge funding, which is where you borrow money from Soros Fund Enterprises or whatever it is called. I cannot remember what it's called. Soros Fund something. But either which way, you borrow money from Soros, and then regardless of whether it works or doesn't work, you're still on the hook and you still have to pay Soros back afterwards.
And so right.
Technically, many of the people who are pushing this thing don't actually care whether it works or doesn't work because you still have to pay them back after it's done.
Right, right. And by the way, to your point earlier, GW, I think we can't dismiss the ideological founders of the European Union, which I track back to Kudinov Kalergi, for example, who together with Otto von Habsburg outlined some of the main ideas for the European Union, many that actually were put into place later, such as, you know, symbolic acts such as the national anthem, the flag, and these kinds of things. But, you know, they went on, or, you know, Kalergi went on to create the Pan-European Union. And, you know, much of the explanation we get is, well, after it was after the Second World War, these horrors had occurred. We can never let this happen again. Let's form a union so that we prevent this. But that's actually a lie, because he outlined this in 1925 in Practical Idealism. And he actually spoke, obviously, at length about the racial issue here. He was of mixed race himself, and he saw that the new European should be, in his words, become a Eurasian Negroid race, right? So if that's kind of some of the ideological foundations of the European Union, I think they're simply just enforcing this. They still have Kalergi prizes that they give out to people, right?
I think it's going to be much more complex than that. I think that there's going to be a real web of motives, personal motives, group motives, particular interests, economic interests that mesh together and provide. You have to remember that the human psyche is quite a weak piece of equipment. It has a tendency to go along in most cases with what is already happening around it and with what people are already saying must happen around it. The number of people in the world who will stand up, you know, and do an Enoch Powell are few and far between. It's an unfortunate fact. And consequently, you know, if something is established in a clever way, then sooner or later, yes, there'll be a nexus of others coming along, working within that same general way of thinking, and in no time at all, everybody is seeing this thing's inevitable. This it has a life of its own, and so on and so forth. So I can see that something would become enmeshed in this way. One particular idea would become enmeshed in its way. But to explain something quite as extreme as this, I don't think you can say, "Oh, well, there was this guy Kalergi."
Oh, not only him, Kalergi, of course not.
Know,
no.
Or I don't think you can say, well, there's jury. Jury is deeply involved. There's no question about that in every possible way. But I don't think that it's really feasible to explain the massive amount of support which exists for every single element. You know, in the hyper-egalitarian neo-Marxism. I mean, you know, these crazy ideas about homosexual equality or the no difference between men and women. You just bring up a boy like a girl and there's all this plasticity. It's, you know, these are crazy ideas. They're obviously wrong. Anybody who's got any kind of feet on the ground, contact to human nature, who has any kind of instinctual sense in him, knows that this is wild. But there is a general acceptance in amongst the educated class, the university left, of course, but also the conservatives all across Europe. They think the same stuff. They're not challenging it. When they get into power, they don't undo it. They see it's inevitable. It's ratchet, you know, the ratchet is clicked. So you have to see this is a very complex issue, which results in a very wide range of generally debilitating social and cultural and genetic and racial factors at work. And to explain all of this, you know, just is an immense task, and it should be the task of nationalism to do this. We tend to do it in a very, I mean, we do address it, of course we do, but we never address it in a really scholarly way. I mean, the only really good scholarly work in the whole of the nationalist field, the really solid scholarly work that picks on one area of that and absolutely nails it, is MacDonald. There's very little else that we've produced that has that great benefit. Do you imagine if what MacDonald has achieved for us? Now, I know that in America there are lots of nationalists, white nationalists, who have a different take or take issue in one issue or another.
MacDonald is a bit too right wing, and because of that he tends to he doesn't focus on as much on the neoliberal aspect and the susceptibility that our objectivism.
Go on.
Yeah, I think he also, well, he and others also don't look at the fact that it doesn't always boil down to one thing. There's often a compartmentalization where different people are doing different things for different reasons that happen to mesh together in certain ways. So, for example, you know, if we're told on one hand the Cowdenherve Kalergi plan was mentioned previously. Mm. From what we are often told, you would never imagine that the Cowdenherve Kalergi plan was anywhere involved in any of this, because of the fact that it almost looks like you're kind of creating another Reich, if that makes sense. Where, you know, where you have people like Barroso coming out and telling you that, you know, the European Union is an undefined political object because it's the first time that humans have come together with different states and agreed to pool their sovereignty. So it's almost like, you know, something almost neo-Carolingian or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. You would not imagine that Cowdenherve Kalergi had anything to do with some kind of, you know, race-mixy ideology or something like this going on behind it. You're also sold the same thing on a defense pretext as well, which I outlined earlier about, you know, seeing off Russia and making sure they can't enter. There's also the stuff about GW mentioned just now, the stuff about, you know, gender equality and all of these programs that have been going on. They are often presented to us as necessary for national security, believe it or not, because of the fact that these things tramp down the kind of tensions you would expect to see in less advanced countries, particularly in the social media context, because one of the interesting things about social media is that by having everyone on social media talking about these things, you can easily spot who is dissenting by the fact that they have chosen not to adopt the line which has been propagated. And so, you know, there's whole systems of looking through social media to essentially, you know, find out the locations of where political developments are going to happen before they happen. So you can almost see populism coming before it actually comes. All of this kind of stuff has been factored in ahead of time. And so for the defense establishment in particular, we're sold the whole bill of goods under the pretext that this is how you manage things. This is just how you do it, right? And so we would not be aware of the fact that there is some sinister plan behind it or any conspiracy behind any of this, because it all is presented in a completely natural way. Like, oh, that's just what you do. That's how you administrate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
Which is very unfortunate, because of the fact that, you know, sometimes there really is something sinister behind it. Of course, you don't get to find this out until after you've created a disaster, perhaps.
Right.
Yeah, I'd just like to have a really good scholarly history of the whole damn thing, so that we've got it set out. As I was trying to say, you know, in the way that we have on jury as a result of McDonald's work, I'd like to see that across the board.
I do think that you're giving somewhat short shrift to my analysis of the white leftist thing. I mean, it explains quite well what Jewish motivations and how they basically want us to adopt this moniker of right wingers, and it makes sense through ordinary language that what's happening is they're discouraging us from unionization and from social organization should be our native kinds. And that automatically establishes an in and an out group. They want to misrepresent leftism as all these crazy things, which really aren't leftism. Not for us, they're liberalism, and they have us reacting, you know, repulsed by all this misrepresentation, all this craziness. To where, so people say, oh yes, okay, I'm a right winger. And what that means is that you're effectively, you're antisocial. You have all these abstractions that you're relying upon, and you're reacting, and let me finish. You're not organizing. So what happens is, as a result, you have people who are going crazy. You know, this mayor guy, he acts in this completely insensible way, because he's gone insane. He doesn't have the normalization. Well, he doesn't. Let me finish. He doesn't have the normalization of praxis of his social group to sort these things out. He has only some, you know, grappling for some Cartesian point in his head, and this is where, you know, the language games that Jews are playing are not entirely impossible to sort out. That's one of the most fundamental things, is that they want to discourage Europeans from the latest and best means of social organization and of ways of understanding the world, the relationship of knower to known.
Well, I'm just going to jump in for a second. I see that people often say, you know, liberalism has created this. But no one ever seems to define what neoliberalism is when everyone invokes this term. The way I see neoliberalism is that previously, when it was just, I guess you could call it plain old liberalism, there was the view that, you know, markets are emergent. You kind of just sit there and markets bubble up out of the ether and they're just there or something. You know, people walk up to each other and they say, you know, do you want a product? And if the answer is yes, then you enter, you know, a negotiation with the person as to the price, and then they say no to your price until they find a price level that they want, subjective value theory, and then the trade takes place. Under neoliberalism, they've essentially abandoned this view and turned it on its head. So now you have to kind of prepare the social environment for the market you have already planned to lay down. And so I think the whole European Union project would essentially be about taking a stick to Europeans and essentially making them ready for the market that was to come. And so then you have to ask the question when you're talking about neoliberalism, who is in charge of bringing the stick to make you ready for the market that they're going to impose? Mm-hmm.
Sam Francis used to say Jews acted as janissaries for the elites. I think I probably just described the modus operandi.
Well, let me and this is an interesting thread. It's very, you know, we're deep into the discussion, and I don't want to break it up, but we can definitely just continue this after the break. I wanted to spend just a few minutes speaking a bit more about the upcoming vote, because we can go around the table here. Let's assume that we get a leave vote, right? Britain wants to leave. What would happen at this point? How would things change? And would the political class in Britain actually implement this? We can, for example, look at Ireland, what happened in Ireland, right, in terms of the referendum that they had there, where the political class pushed the vote on them until they voted yes to join, right? Because there was also one of these watershed points, if you will, which could maybe not make or break the European Union, but it was an important one, right?
The IQ, the average IQ in Ireland is very low because of immigration. The average IQ of our people, if you leave aside the immigrants, many of whom have quite a high IQ, because in the first generation, certainly, even for Africans, immigration adds a standard deviation. So you tend to get some pretty good stock, in actual fact. But of course, then you get regression to the mean over a few generations. But, you know, Ireland has had some centuries of powerful immigration, more powerful at some times than others, obviously. It was a very, very bloody history, coping with the big neighbor across the sea. And as a result of that, of course, you know, you may not have the real Irish quality in terms of its capacity to its capacity to stand up against psychological warfare and psychological things.
Right.
What it does have is a very, very courageous but violently wrong capacity to blow up innocent people to get its political ends. We know that. I mean, you get that. But that's not the same thing. I think that when you come to the question of whether or not we would be asked to vote again, there are far too many of us, and we are far too stubborn, and we are too intelligent to be pushed around in that way.
So they wouldn't dare to push that on you. Yeah, they wouldn't dare to do that.
I mean, there's basically about 48 million of us, and I just don't think that, you know, they would get away with it. It would increase, not decrease, the determination to. We're bloody-minded. I mean, you know, we sit on this. This is something which the French, of course, learnt a long, long time ago. Perhaps the Germans might have suspected it after a couple of wars, but we're a very, very bloody-minded lot. And we don't really enjoy brotherhood with the rest of Europe. It's not our idea at all. We are seafaring people, and we would rather look out to the world. I just think that there's a tendency, really, for independence of mind, which you cannot legislate against in Brussels. So we won't be asked to vote again. What may happen, it's been mentioned, is the political class will find some way of entering into a horribly complex and ultimately failing negotiation with the EU to mm-hmm. come out with anything like terms which, and of course, if that happens, then all bets are off what the bloody-minded populace will do, because the political center is moving. And those who would do that, basically the internationalists, the establishment type, are going to find themselves rather out on a limb as it continues to move. So I don't think that they'll have the same power base that they imagine they enjoy today. And I've written in that piece I put up the other day that I think on the morning after the vote, providing this latest affair with Joe Cox isn't turned into some kind of cause célèbre which upsets things and moves things back again towards Remain, which is possible, but I think unlikely, we're going to see a very, very large majority for freedom and autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
Something of the order of 65-70% is my estimate of what is really there in the country.
Where's the polls at right now, by the way? Where's the polls at?
10% lead for Brexit.
Yeah, it's getting there.
Excellent.
It's getting there. 55-45. But what you've got to remember, just to, by way of a digression on this, a few years ago, some of the MR crowd, James Barry, of course, who you know,
yes.
Mike Rienzi, one or two others, got interested in the Political Compass website. Do you know the Political Compass?
I recognize it. Yeah, I haven't visited too much, but yeah.
Okay, well, the Political Compass is a psychologically sound piece of software. It's an engine that calculates where you are on a graph. And the graph has got two central axes, a cruciform, which are based on the standard liberal dispensation, so that you've got authoritarianism on one side and libertarianism on another. I forget what the north south one is now. It's probably something to do with
north south is authoritarian libertarian, and
right.
East west is economic leftism, economic
right.
rightism.
Right. Okay. So socialism, basically, and individualism.
Yeah. And the quadrants have colors. So the top left quadrant, for example, is red. Across the other side is blue, and then underneath it is green, and the other side is some other color, yellow.
So this collection of MR people who piled onto this website to give it a go, and we expected, being nationalists, we were all nationalists. We all thought the same things. We all had the same information in our lives. We all had the same determination to achieve certain goals. We were pretty much united in that respect. We popped up all over the place on this damn graph.
Where did you come up? It didn't make any sense
at all. Oh, I can't remember. I was somewhere around the middle, but I'm pretty damned extreme, really. I was just to the right of the middle, but there were people everywhere.
When I take it, I come up in the middle of the red square on the left. Slightly close to the top. So essentially the Political Compass considers me authoritarian left, which is kind of interesting.
So you would be a sort of Strasserite or something. I don't know.
Something like this. They think.
Right, okay. Well, my point at issue is that, to get back to what I was saying before, the liberal mind, brought into fruition, educated in the very subtle and manifold sensibilities and values of liberalism, which is a founding psychological substrate, on which the personality in the West rests, not just politically, but in every other way. It's deep in our attitudes. It's in our enculturalization. The liberal mind in that cast just can't do nationalism. This is what I discovered when I set up
Emma.
It just can't do it. It can't find the values.
It can't even map it. Even on the Wikipedia for left-right spectrum, they actually have a section there now where they concede that ethno-nationalist parties essentially cannot usually be placed coherently onto the spectrum they have designed because it appears everywhere.
Right.
Well, what a clever thing for them to understand. It is true, and we understood that. This is going back to about 2005, which we grasped it all then. And we became interested, particularly James Barry, in constructing an engine of our own that would actually attend to the concerns and values and thought forms that we have.
Right.
So the question arises about pollsters. These guys, you know, I read Anthony Wells, he's a YouGov guy, he's senior director of YouGov. I read his blog quite regularly, and there are all these guys who are in that business who come on and talk technically about polls. And there are quite a lot of ordinary political bods who go on and get in the way. But, you know, these guys are very, very much sort of university left type graduates. Who've gone into the political system. They've never had what you would regard as being a real job. They are part of the, you know, the Westminster bubble, we say. They're the bubble people. They don't know really what a patriot is. They can't grasp that. They think it's something vaguely immoral. That's their problem. And they are expected somehow to produce a sample base of people which actually reflects in some way the reality of the wider population. They can't do it. It didn't matter in terms of the general sort of left-right intra-liberal polling for general elections. That's okay. But this election has got these other elements which take you away from that and into some fairly nationalist stuff. They can't do that. They can't do that at all.
All right. Obviously, a Brexit would be going in the right direction. Yeah, Kumiko, please add your thoughts here quick if you can. Yeah,
of course. Yeah, I want to augment what GW said, but, you know, in a way that adds on to what you asked initially about whether these people will really actually go through with Brexit if it is presented to them as in the form of the referendum coming back as Brexit now. I think that they actually will. The elements of the ruling class that have decided that, that their interests lie outside of the European Union, I think they're deadly serious about what they're saying. At the moment, who are the three leaders of the Brexit campaign if you were to essentially narrow the field down? You have Michael Gove, correct? You have Boris Johnson, and you also have Priti Patel. All three of these individuals have both personal and financial reasons to actually go through with what they're doing, as well as career-based reasons as well. They wouldn't want to sacrifice their political careers by turning around and, you know, selling people a short bill of goods after they have been given what they wanted, particularly in the case of Gove and Patel, because of the fact that both of them stand to gain from a Brexit vote, and many of the people who are backing Brexit, particularly on the back benches of the Tory party and so on, all of these people are actually invested in the in outcomes that are Brexit-like. So I think that they would enjoy it purely because of the fact that they're going to make money off of it in actual fact. So we don't have to worry about the idea that they would sell us out at the end of all of this, because they have their own selfish reasons for doing what they do as well. So you can almost rely on their selfishness to some extent.
So it's both sides, isn't it? It's a political necessity and a personal necessity.
Oh, yes.
In their case. I think in the case of Michael Gove, I think he is a principled individual. And I think he's done this on grounds of principle. I think that the other person who's in the Conservative Party, but he's something of a gris aminence these days, not really a...
Boris Johnson.
No, David Davis, who's
man
of
principle. Oh, right, yes.
He doesn't, at the moment, I would say, he doesn't have a future in terms of government unless he's bought in. He's one of these heavyweight backbenchers for life now. He threw away his ministerial career resigning as Home Secretary.
Yeah, he sacrificed himself, which was incredible. I've never seen
yeah.
that happen.
He's a man of very high principle. They're very rare, and he is one of them. And I believe Michael Gove is another. And I don't think that goes, you know, motivated by personal financial concerns. I can't speak for Priti Patel. She seems pretty sound. But, I mean, she would never rise very high in the government for one obvious reason, and because there's not time for an Indian prime minister. Not a problem with being a woman, and it's not a problem with being a right-wing woman, but it is being, I think, you know, it's too early for an Indian.
Yeah, trying to get the public to accept this would be a bit of a, at this stage at least. And then there was also a question about what they would do after they exited, the day after they exited. I think that what their actual plan is not that they're going to try to immediately sign some kind of like weird agreement with the EU and then spend the next 10 years trying to disentangle themselves, because that would be catastrophe. I think from what I've seen of their writings, their plan is to exit and make a clean cut immediately, repatriate all of the European laws that presently exist on the book that are enacted, repatriate these to the UK so that they effectively stand as UK laws, and then they will pick those apart at their leisure themselves after they've exited, which is far more sensible, rather than being in the situation of having the EU negotiating with you on what you can pick apart. Just take the whole thing and then pick it apart at your leisure. The other thing which is going to happen, which I'm pretty sure, like about 90% sure is going to happen, after they exit, they're not going to mess about with any of this kind of like, you know, which country are we going to imitate kind of thing. What they're probably going to do is join this thing called the EFTA, which replaces them in the same category as Norway, Iceland, and some other country whose name I forget. Switzerland?
Right. Yeah, maybe.
And so they're going to... Yeah, so they're going to enter the EFTA.
Well, can I throw a geopolitical point into here to this? This is something which you've missed out. All right, go on.
If they enter the EFTA after exiting the European Union, that would mean the EFTA would become the fourth largest trading entity in the world. That would placing them just ahead of Japan and just behind the People's Republic of China. So it would be very significant.
All right, you get the last word here, Jiwin, and then we need to take a break, so go ahead.
Well, okay, I was actually going to, perhaps we should restart this after the break then. The point I wanted to raise was that the Americans have yet to speak, because there is an election in America in November. And if it is a victory for Donald Trump, that will have a completely different outcome in terms of American policy towards Britain and Europe than it would do if Hillary Clinton won.
Yes, absolutely
Trump.
Right.
Yeah. Then, yes. You know, there's a possibility in terms of the kind of offers and might be available commercially to British companies in, you know, I don't mean in terms of a trade agreement, but certainly something that would loosen things up a bit. And I'm a bit uncertain about exactly what they mean. I saw an article the other day by somebody in the political system on the right who's saying we will welcome the British, you know, we will not do this and do that to them, such as has been threatened by Clinton, husband Clinton, I might add, not wife. but so, I mean, you know, the American factor has to be to be taken into account at some point. And, you know, Kimiko is probably somebody's got a view on that, but also I think Daniel has. So maybe we should start with that after the break.
Yeah, exactly. Much more to discuss. Interesting conversation here. We'll continue with that. And of course, I have much more to ask you guys. As we continue. Now, the website again here, of course, ladies and gentlemen, majorityrights.com. That's where you can go to read more, both from GW, also known as Guest Worker, and Kumiko, and Daniel S. as well. But we're going to take a short break here. By the way, do you guys have any, I don't know, Twitter, Facebook, or anything like that beyond the website you'd like to give out if people want to follow you or something like that? Any one of you?
Not
yeah,
yet.
I do. I do. I have the Majority Rights Twitter account under my name, Daniel Sienkiewicz. And you can find me there. And I'm connected to Red Eyes Radio.
Yes, absolutely. We'll add a link. Perfect. We'll add a link to you there as well. Yeah, exactly. All right, well, super. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned, everyone.
söker ingen tumor än sönder. Han har galleri